to Danoff, Mike. July is the month when new laws take effect in Indiana. This month, several new laws have kicked in to aid county prosecutors. Laws that close loopholes for drug dealers, new protections for statutes that some may want to topple, going after catalytic converter thieves and their buyers, and domestic abusers. But data is the big one that will allow prosecutors to go after digital data easier to solve crimes. We also talked to the organizers of a youth baseball team in Gary that's trying to raise funds to head to a state tournament, and what's in store for the second half of the Major League Baseball season, and will they be able to get off the Olympics? We'll find out. All this on Off Mic. Welcome to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm your host, Michael Puente, reporter with WBEZ in Chicago. Our first segment is going to sound something like a TV crime drama. Okay, so we all know how nifty cell phones can be. They aren't merely a phone, however. They are mini computers. They store a lot of data from photos, videos, games, and apps that can add to our lives or use for more sinister things. More often than not, the data in your phone can provide clues or downright evidence in solving crimes. And a new law in Indiana that started earlier this month aims to help prosecutors in the collection of that evidence. Joining me to talk about this new law and a few others is one of the longest-serving elected county prosecutors, not just in Indiana, but the nation, Lake County Prosecutor Bernard Carter. Welcome to Off Mic, Bernie.
Hey, fine, Mike. How are you?
All right. Okay, Bernie, well, we wanted to talk to you a little bit about the some of the new laws that are kicking in. One of them is HEA 1082. That involves high-tech crimes. What can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, you know, the Senate and the House of Representatives passed a bill that essentially allows IPAC, that's Indiana Prosecuting Attorneys Association, to establish 10 high-tech crime units throughout the state. And it's controlled and operated by each elected prosecutor in those 10 locations. So what's going on now is they're taking applications, and each entity that or county that's interested in it is starting to put together a package, a proposal, so they could be one of the 10. Here in Lake County, we obviously think that we certainly deserve one of those units. And we've been in the process now of putting together a very detailed proposal asking for one of those units. Essentially, what the units will encompass, you're talking about $600,000 for 2 years to get it established, and then it's further further funding down the line. But the first 2 years, the allocation is $600,000 for each unit. The unit consists of an association with one of the universities in your community. And in this case, we have came to an agreement as of yesterday with Purdue University. The chancellor there was very encouraged by the program. He thought it would be a great idea for his students as well as his university. And we equally feel the same way. They're going to be providing housing for us, office space, furniture, the phone system. They have a secured location that they're going to be able to put us in. So, because one of the things that the high-tech unit has to have, it has to be in a secure building with a lot of firewalls and protections and things of that nature. And they have an excellent location there, waiting to be used. So we're going to just kind of step right into that. So that's going to help our proposal, I think, a great deal. But essentially what this high-tech crime unit will do is it will go to the crime scene of any type of crime that they think that they will be able to get computers, cell phones, cameras, any kind of technology device that could record something. This unit would go in, secure it, maintain it, analyze it, and have it prepared for the prosecutors to prosecute cases using that information. You know, one of the interesting things about the high-tech crime unit is this. just about every crime that is committed now, almost every crime, I don't care what it could be. It could be a child molesting. It could be auto theft. It could be murder. It could be rape. The person who is committing that crime has in their possession a cell phone. Nowadays, a cell phone is a computer. It's a camera. It encompasses everything. You can order anything off of a cell phone. You can communicate with a co-defendant or a cohort in an effort to in criminal enterprise. So we go in and grab the cell phones. We can get a whole history of what this person's been up to in the last 2 or 3 weeks. Who they communicated with. Who called in to them, who they called into, who texted them, who sent them photographs or pictures. So it's just amazing now how cell phones in particular is playing a part in criminal prosecution.
Wow, wow. Yeah, you know, this is one of the ways where sometimes technology can outpace the law and even government, but this is one of your efforts to try to catch up a little bit.
Absolutely. That's a good way to put it, too. That's just how we see it, too.
Right, right. And do you still have to get on, like, in terms of, like, you're right, the cell phone. It's, you know, sometimes people, like, older people will say, well, you're always on your cell phone. But the cell phone isn't just a phone. It is a computer. It's a texting thing. You're looking up
Absolutely.
Everything. Do you Absolutely. Still have to get court orders to get things like Facebook interactions, Twitter, all these other different things?
Oh, yeah. This unit will specialize in that. We currently now do a large part of that. Our office is set up where we issue search warrants when police officers apprehend or take into possession evidence of this nature. And this unit that we're setting up will be automatic within them to be preparing search warrants and getting search warrants. Because many times after you take possession of some of this evidence, you have to still get a search warrant to go into it and analyze it, even though you got possession of it. So we go into a raid on a drug raid, and we grab computer cell phones, and we take them back to our office. We don't go into them at that point. We then get a search warrant to go in, indicating to the court we got reason to believe that criminal activity is on this cell phone, and it may help us in our investigation. So you're absolutely right. In every instance, a search warrant pretty much going to be necessary. Even if the suspect allow us to go into it, we recommend to police and investigators to go ahead and still get the search warrant.
You know, and it does seem like, I would say young people, but maybe even middle-aged people, they seem to like to document everything from what they're eating, but also a lot of them like to record things, personal things that they do. So like you mentioned, it could be child molestation. These people sometimes post it on things like Snapchat or Instagram, they act like it's private, but it's public out there. Those are the type of things you try to go after, correct?
Oh, that's absolutely correct. Particularly, you mentioned child molesting or some type of pornographic material dealing with juveniles or any kind of criminal activity like that. It's been proven, and we know that people who participate in this type of stuff, they like to look at those types of things and reserve them and maintain them. Then they'll go back and they get satisfaction out of possessing it, and also satisfaction out of sharing it or selling it to another person that want to look at it for that illegal purpose. So that material is on there to be preserved by them for their satisfaction. So that's something that we definitely want to be able to get into and analyze. You know, another part of the unit is, and is required too, in light of the fact that our investigators will be looking at cell phones with all this kind of illegal pornographic material, is that we are required to give counseling to every person who works within this unit, because what's going to happen with this unit, we're going to use college students too to do some of our analyzing. So if they're looking at things that nobody really want to ever look at, for the most part, you know, they need counseling for that, and they need some direction on that. So it would be built in our system too to provide counseling for all of our employees.
Well, let me ask you something, Bertie. And a lot of times young people who are thinking about going into college or doing some kind of technical background or job, they may not look at criminal justice as a route. But, you need some of those young people who know how to work. There's a new app that is coming out for everything, but you need people to know how to use this. Is this also a way to kind of recruit younger people to go into the profession?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, one of the things, I talked to Pat Harrington. He's down in Lafayette, and they have a program similar to what the state is trying to do now. And he said that if you don't have anybody in there 28 and younger, you're in trouble. And that's true what you're saying. I mean, these young people, they know the technology. They grow with the technology. Now they're born with it. So you really have to look at them as being some of our future leaders and certainly future people who can take us in that direction.
All right, Bernie, we'll move on a little bit because there's another interesting law that has come into effect on July 1st, which is very interesting to me. And a lot of people might think, well, we've been hearing about this, but it's about the theft of catalytic converters, which has been something that has been going on for, it seems like, years. What is this new law that's going to give you sort of new tools to combat this?
Well, one of the things that they're trying to do is, they, as you mentioned, it's extremely expensive, very expensive, the catalytic converter itself, to buy, to rebuy. If it's stolen from a car owner, many times the insurance won't cover it, so they have to pay for it themselves. And it could be several thousand dollars with installation. Also, one of the things we know is when they steal the catalytic converters, now what they're using these skill saws and they battery-operated 18-24-volt batteries, and they just go up underneath the car, roll under there, and just cut it out. And they ruin the whole muffler system, the whole exhaust system. So many times that entire system has to be replaced. So legislators understand that, and they're basically putting an additional sentencing range on these here. And they're making it where it could be a level 6 or level 5. A level 6 is kind of similar to old days of a Class D felony. Level 5 is probably like a Class C or B felony, whereas the jail time is increased drastically for that violation. In addition to it, they're making it the person who purchased it, the junkyard or whatever, they're increasing the penalty on that. So they're trying to put pressure on them not to be buying these from the individual, because if there's no purchaser, then there's no demand. There's no demand, then they're not going to be crawling underneath your car taking your catalytic converter because it has no value. But it has value, obviously, now because they can resell it on the market for a very good a price. And it's very dangerous for the homeowner. It's very dangerous for the person who's removing it because, you know, we've had situations where people look out their window, saw somebody, I remember a case in particular, saw somebody trying to take the car, basically, and he shot the assailant and killed him. So, you know, that's not good for society. It ended up being a 16-year-old kid trying to steal a car. So, you know, taking these people, catalytic converters and things of that nature, certainly is a concern for all of us in our community.
You know, it is interesting that people are still trying to, because I've been hearing about thefts of catalytic converters, you know, for several decades now. And it's a very, maybe are unaware, but it's a very important part. It's legally required that you have one to reduce toxic emissions, pollutions, basically, from the environment.
That's correct. And when it's removed from your car, basically, you have to put another one back on there to stay within the legal guidelines. So it's not something that you can't, once that catalytic converter is taken off that car, you can't run that car. You can't operate that car. It's very loud. So you have to either bypass it and put another pipe in there, and that's illegal, or you have to go and purchase another one. And you have to, you know, here in Lake County, you have to pass the emission standards too. So no way you would pass the emission standards without a catalytic converter.
Not to digress too much, but there's a very interesting Hollywood blockbuster movie that just came out called No Sudden Move. It's with Brandon Fraser, Don Cheadle, Benicio del Toro. That it talks about Matt Damon, Ray Liotta. It talks about the history of getting the catalytic converters into American cars and the fight that it took for the government to get them into the cars, because so many of the big three, the big automakers, were so much against it. So for history buffs out there, you may want to go check out that movie.
Well, I'm certainly going to check it out. I've heard of it. I haven't seen it, but I definitely want to see it.
Well, the last thing you would think, they could make a Hollywood blockbuster about catalytic converters, but they did it.
That's
so,
sure. Yeah.
So another thing that has come up, you know, certainly I've been trying to think of how to sort of tie this into Northwest Indiana. But one of them is SEA 187. It's about protecting monuments, memorials, and statues. You know, obviously this grew out of a lot of the social unrest we've had over the years over around the country, where people who are kind of socially conscious have been going after statues that they deem they don't like. Have you seen this as being much of an issue in Northwest Indiana?
Not to my knowledge. I know I've not had any problems with someone bringing it to me in terms of some kind of a criminal act or whatever the case may be. We've been very fortunate in Lake County with those types of riots and with those types of not having those kind of concerns of people coming due to unrest in the community. So we've been very fortunate in that regard. Now, I think in some of the southern parts of the state and other counties, some of those monuments are there, and many of the people in say more of the urban areas of those counties may protest to it. But here in Lake County, we've not had that problem thus far. But it is a concern throughout the state. That's why I think Indiana is picking up on it and certainly increasing the penalty for those and making it a felony. So normally it would be a misdemeanor, like a criminal mischief.
Right.
And now they're making it a felony to remove, and possibly a level 6 or level 5 felony if certain amount of property damage is done to the monument.
I'm sure the law doesn't apply to this, but I hope if somebody ever goes after the Howards and Sons cow in Munster, I hope they can apply the law to this. Okay.
Yeah.
Couple of other things that have come out, and it's probably a big one for you, Bernie, is sentencing as it relates to drug dealers, that it's closing a loophole that I guess drug users have been using for several years. Do you know anything about that one?
Yeah, I sure do, because I was on the committee, was kind of pushing that through the state, and it was a concern to me because, you know, I'm a real big believer, and Mike, you know me over the years, in second chances. I promote that. I do it in our plea agreements. I try to get young people. I don't want to give a young person a felony conviction if we can avoid it. If there's no personal injury, there's no injury to the community, it's a theft or something that doesn't involve injury to a person or a human being in any capacity, you know, I'm always willing to give a second chance and say, hopefully this young man won't come back and learn his lesson with a misdemeanor as opposed to a felony. However, we have those who do get felony convictions, and they continue to do criminal acts, and they continue to come before the court, and for whatever reason, the court suspends their sentence and give them probation once again. And what this law basically says, if you're charged with a drug transaction and you plead guilty or you're found guilty and you get probation and you come back, within 10 years, I think it is, but it's within the limit. Well, it would probably follow, but our application would probably be within 10 years, but I think it's indefinite. But if you come back before the court and you get charged with the same offense again, this is for repeat offenders, then the judge has no option but to send you to the Department of Corrections and have to sentence you within that sentencing guideline, whatever the term of the sentence of that charge is. But the judge cannot give you probation, cannot send you to work release, cannot give you alternative sentencing. And what we're trying to be is send the message that once is enough. Twice is obviously too many. And certainly the third time, you should be going to jail. In this change, the second time, you will be going to jail on a conviction.
All right. And probably the last one is SEA 79. It's about protective orders and domestic battery. How does this apply now? How this new law can it be applied?
Well, you know, what we're looking at is that particular section is dealing with strangulation and calling for a stiffer penalty when a person engaged in domestic batteries and a subsequent domestic battery, kind of equal to the drug type thing, where a person is given probation or whatever prohibits them from not doing some type of jail time for that violation. As far as the protective order, it gives the court the right to do it automatic. And when, many times when a person comes in, we do a protective order on that person, knowing that they may have a propensity to do domestic violence, and that kind of protects the victim from any future actions. If the person comes back toward them, then we can make an arrest without actually filing charges for the second offense.
We're talking to Bernard Carter, longtime prosecutor for Lake County, Indiana, about the new laws that have gone into effect this month that aids in criminal prosecutions. Bernie, I do have to ask you about a high-profile police-involved shooting out of Gary back in November 2019. A Gary police officer responded to a report of an intoxicated man with a weapon at an apartment on Roosevelt Street in Gary. Investigators said they found 82-year-old Melvin Bowler with a gun. He was also intoxicated and threatened to use the gun to harm himself and others. The officer from Gary responded, said Bowler was sitting in a car outside the complex when he pulled out a silver revolver from his right pocket and pointed it at the officer. The officer fired. Bowler was struck several times and critically wounded. Authorities said they recovered a loaded weapon from inside his red Nissan Altima. He died 2 months later. And just yesterday, a grand jury decided not to bring criminal charges against the officer. Prosecutor Bernard Carter, what can you tell us about that decision?
Yeah, I can say this, and I can say what I said at the press conference. Okay. I'm prohibited by state statute. It's 3534-10-2 that says that essentially that it's improper for a prosecutor to speak on testimonial evidence in a grand jury setting. So what we did a press release, and we allowed the sheriff to send to read a 15-page summary of their investigation as to this crime or alleged act.
All right.
At the press conference, I announced that the grand jury today, approximately 10 a.m., returned a no indictment verdict. So essentially, they did not bring any charges against this police officer. We had submitted charges for murder, and we submitted charges for reckless homicide to the grand jury. And in that return, they found no evidence to amount to that. And I announced that this morning.
All right. And this isn't something where you would charge Gary police officer Brandon Henderson on your own.
That's correct. Well, it went to a grand jury. So once it goes to a grand jury, then they hear the evidence and they make that decision. I had the right as a prosecutor not to take it to a grand jury and make that decision myself through my office. But we decided based on the evidence and based on what was presented, we wanted a full view heard by an entity such as a grand jury and let them make a determination.
Well, Bernie, let me ask you this, just in a broader sense. We've been, you know, obviously we hear a lot about police-involved shootings, especially when it comes to African-Americans. This is something that people sometimes will like think that, you know, prosecutors and police are on the same side, but you are also there to protect the public and you're also African-American. Do you feel generally that the courts give or the police? Well, let me ask you this. How do you feel in terms of overall, can African-Americans and minorities, is there enough justice in the justice system for people of color?
Well, that's a tough question, and it's a difficult question in light of the fact that it's been going on across our country. And I would be blind not to say that that there's a problem there, and there is a problem there. But one of the things I clearly know is that in policing, you have some very good police officers, and police officers who go on duty to do the public's work. They're there and to protect us. You do have those who don't have the public interest in mind, and they out of control. Those individuals, one, should not be on the police force. Two, if they are alleged to have committed some act like that or did something like that, they should be charged, criminally charged. They should be fired, and they certainly should be prosecuted, and they should be incarcerated. I'm very strong on that issue. I'm also understand that the public don't trust the relationship between the prosecutor in a local jurisdiction and the police department in the same jurisdiction that they work with every day. And that's a problem. And I'm working with Indiana Prosecuting Attorneys Association. I'm on one of the committees that's taking a real hard look at, and we're going to do something about this, where if a homicide or a shooting occurs where a police officer is involved and it results in a death, that case automatically is shifted to the state police for investigation. Secondly, it's shifted to a outside prosecutor coming in to review that case. The local prosecutor would not have any jurisdiction over that case. It would be given by a local outside prosecutor to come in and prosecute that case, similar to what they did up in Minnesota. Now, I think that's very important because the nexus between a local prosecutor and the current police department in that jurisdiction is a very close nexus. But I do know prosecutors take their job very seriously, and they will prosecute, such as myself. I will prosecute a police officer. I have prosecuted, 50, 60 police officers for various criminal activities over the years. None for police-related shooting, however, but certainly for any other kind of criminal offense that you can name almost, we prosecute the police. So I'm a strong believer that no one is above the law. No one can do things that is interpreted as being improper or illegal, and in my opinion, get away with it when one can easily see that this activity is going on. So clearly, if someone is doing something that is illegal and they happen to be a police officer, that individual should be prosecuted for that act, and that includes a police-related shooting, if in fact it was an unjustified shooting. And that's the issue right there: is the act that the police officer is doing is justified. If it is, then we have to, as a community and as a public, have to protect that officer. If the officer stretches outside of that and does something that is resulted as to just outright murder, then he should be prosecuted or she should be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law.
Okay, Bernie Carter, prosecutor, Lake County, Indiana. Bernie, thank you so much for joining us here today.
No, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
And we'll be back with more Offline. Welcome back to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I am Michael Puente. Major League Baseball gets underway for the second half of the season. We'll get an update on both of Chicago's baseball teams later in the program. But baseball is also being played locally in Gary. One team is doing so well and is now going to be heading downstate for a tournament, but money is standing in the way of that trip. Joining me to talk about the Calumet Region Baseball Senior League All-Stars is Coach Ermin Hill. Ermin, welcome to Off Mic.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Great. Okay, well, first of all, before we get into the whole money situation, tell me about your All-Stars. Who's on the team? Where do you get kids from? And why are you so good? So tell me a little bit about the league.
Well, we're a 14 to 16-year-old. This is a 14 to 16-year-old All-Star team. Most of these young men do play for their high school in the region and in the area. We're unexpected to win. We weren't expected to win this year, but the kids really worked hard and they've improved so much that we came out being victorious and we won the district, which is really like all of Northwest Indiana. So we'll be representing all of Northwest Indiana down at the state championship.
How many teams do you actually have in your Calumet Region Baseball League?
Well, we have over about 10 teams. We have girls softball. We also have, we go from ages 8 to 16. So we have quite a few teams.
And so then you have to actually, you select the All-Stars from the teams in your league, correct?
Correct. We select the All-Stars from the teams in our league, and we've been playing since the 4th of July weekend.
Great. And I'm trying to remember when I was that age and playing senior league and little league baseball, probably the best time of my life, actually, growing up. And how long has the league been around?
Well, Calumet Region is actually compiled of other leagues such as Miller Little League, Gary Metro League, Maryville Little League, Longfellow Little League, at Lake Station Little League. So it's only now it's only one Little League. You know, back in the day, we used to have quite a few. But now, because, you know, it's, baseball has not been that popular in the area, we condensed it to one league. We've been around about 3 years.
Right, right, right. You know, it does seem strange when you say that, that baseball hasn't been as popular. Why do you think that is? Because growing up, I grew up in East Chicago, and I was part of the Indiana Harbor Little League, and one of my former teammates was some kid who was terrible at baseball named Kenny Lofton. And, you know, baseball was, you know, it was our lives, you know, especially when you're a short Latino kid who, you know, I had a great jump shot, but I wasn't going to be able to, like, shoot that shot up above anybody on the playground too much. So baseball was it. Why do you think baseball's been lagging in this area?
You know, it's funny that you said that, because you're absolutely right. Baseball was like when we were growing up. I know you said you played with Kenny, and Kenny, you know, Kenny's an awesome, awesome guy. But I played with Troy Hall.
Wow.
So it's like we live at the baseball.
Yeah, absolutely.
But the thing now with the youth is basketball. And they rather play basketball, and they lost interest in playing baseball. That's really the thing that really, you know, brought the downfall, you could say, Little League baseball and baseball in our area. But with this, hope this will inspire and we can build it back up.
Do you think part of that just has to do with, it's easier just to pick up a basketball, you got a court, you got a hoop, that's all you really need. You could even play in your driveway if you have a hoop. Where baseball, if the fields aren't kept up, if it's muddy, if there's weeds, you got to have cleats, and bats are expensive, balls are expensive, and you got to have at least a few players to at least play strikeout or home run derby. It's hard to get that many kids to want to play baseball.
You know, I think that has something to do with it, but I also believe that it's just about people like me and the different coaches and the parents to just get out and expose our kids to the sport. Because you know, it's a lot of work, like you said, you have to upkeep the fields and things of that nature. But if you're willing to do it, the kids that play, they really love it.
Yeah. And I also find out that just because you're tall doesn't mean you're gonna be good at basketball. So if you're exposed to something else, pitcher, catcher, running, you may have traits that, like, yeah, you know what, I am tall, but I'd rather play baseball. You're just exposed to something different.
Correct, and it's a great opportunity. And you know, when I was coming up, a lot of the guys I played with, their education got paid through us playing baseball. You know, a lot of us got scholarships to go and play in college. You know, and to get our degrees and our education. So that was a great outlet for us, and it was an opportunity for us to, you know, see the world and see different things.
Well, I also teach at Calumet College of St. Joseph, and put a little plug in there. I know they give scholarships for local baseball players to go to that school, and they right. travel. They travel to Florida and everything to play other teams. So just a little plug right. for the local college. So tell me about your team now. You're heading down to Greenwood, Indiana, the next coming days, but you got hotel expensive, lodging, travel. It's expensive. So what are you doing to try to raise that money?
The community has really supported us. I must say the community has gotten behind us. We're doing fundraisers. We have GoFundMe. We have Cash App. And the community, the first of all, I have to give a big shout out to the mayor, because he's championed this whole fundraising effort to help us. And we've gotten some major sponsors along the way. So the community has really stepped up. We're still a little short, but we believe that we're going to meet our goal within the next 2 to 3 days or before we leave.
And where can you get more information on that?
We can go, if you're on Facebook or social media, you can go to Calumet Region Senior All-Star Team, or you can email us at calumetregionbaseball@gmail.com, or you can even give me a call. You know, my number is 219 219-808-9312. 219-808-9312. No donation is too small. We're just trying to, like I said, get the kids down there. And we believe that we're going to do it.
And we will make sure that on our own Facebook page, Lakeshore Public Radio, for Off Mic, that we will put a link to your fundraising efforts, because we want to make sure the kids going down there and have a good time. Let me ask you this. I know you have 14 to 16-year-old players. They're going to be going down to Greenwood, Indiana. What do you hope they come out of this tournament? I know they want to win, but how invaluable are some of the lessons that you're trying to teach these young men or women, if they're on the team, about not just baseball, but about life?
You know, I want to make this a great experience. You know, when we were kids, there were some experiences that we still remember now. And I want to make this a memorable experience for them and to show them that. And what they're seeing now is that the community cares, people care. A lot of people have called and just showed major support. And this is just to show them that, hey, we can do it. We work hard. You can do anything that you put your mind.
Now, Coach, I'm going to put you on the spot right here, and I hope I don't get you in trouble for this. But I know a lot of I don't know how many players do you have on the team?
We have 15 players.
15 players. So I know a lot of kids like hearing their name on the radio. So who are your players?
Oh, man. We have Jaden Williams. We have Clark Troop. We have Jaden Andrews. We have Cal. We have Eric Williams. We have Ivy Evans. We have Arion Brooks. We have Carl Smith. We have Anthony Hort. We have William Jones. We have quite a bit of kids, and seeing names I forget.
Yeah, it's okay. You probably don't have the roster in front of you. Let me ask you this. of that group, I grew up as an all-star, and I'm not trying to put too much of a competitive thing against the kids, but
right. If
you had to guess who's the Kenny Lofton in that group, or who's the next LaTroy Hawkins?
Ooh, that's a very weighted question right there, but Cal Ezell and Brandon Washington are our leaders right now.
Right.
And they're very good. Cal attends Andran. Brandon attends Bishop Knoll. And they're our leaders. They're very, you know, they work very hard. They play baseball all year round. They love the sport. And if I would say two guys to really watch out for, those are the two guys. And I'm sure they're going to lead us when we get down to the state tournament.
That's right. All right. Well, that's all we have for this segment. But if you want to support the Calumet Region Baseball Senior League All-Stars on their trip to Southern Indiana coming up, and you want to help raise funds, you can go to the Lakeshore Public Radio Facebook page and you'll find a link on there. So Coach Ermin Pooch Hill, thank you so much for joining us here today on Off Mic.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you. And we'll be back with more Off Mic. Well, welcome back to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Michael Puente. In our last segment, you just heard about a senior league group out of Gary that is going to be traveling down to Southern Indiana. They're trying to raise funds. And we're reminiscing about names of big name ball players that have come out of Northwest Indiana, LaTroy Hawkins, Kenny Lofton. And I failed to mention Lloyd McClendon, who was a superstar little leaguer who played in the Little League World Series out of Gary and went on to become a professional baseball player for the Cubs, White Sox, Pittsburgh Pirates, manager, and somebody who I'm sure covered Lloyd McClendon during his time in Major League Baseball is the one and only, one of the most veteran sports reporters you'll find anywhere in America. And we're here in Chicago, and we're so lucky to have her as a guest routinely on Off Mic, is Cheryl Raystout. Hey, Cheryl, how are you?
I'm good, Michael. Wow, that's a great intro. I'm almost, you know, red in the face.
Well, I've known Cheryl for such a long time, but honestly, I'm also a big fan of her work. And if you're unfamiliar with Cheryl, she's on Twitter, she's on Facebook, and I'm not, there's a lot of people that are propped up maybe, you know, deservedly so, or maybe not deservingly. She's the real deal. And she comes out on not just WBEZ in Chicago. She's heard on NPR routinely. She's heard on some of the local radio shows talking about baseball, football, basketball, and the BBC. And she's a reporter who does it right. She's not a fan. I'm sure she's internally a fan of some teams, but you won't guess that when you're talking to her. She gives you the unbiased view of all the sports teams. So I'm just
try.
So happy. Yeah. It's hard to because, you know, baseball or football, basketball, the thing about it is you want to cheer. It's almost like eating food and, like, not commenting on it. Like, you got a big deep dish pizza. You take a bite and you're just like, it's good. It's good. So
I learned it a long time ago not to, you know, not to show any emotion. And the worst part about it was when my son was playing Little League and stuff like that, I couldn't cheer because I was trained not to.
Oh, my God. But you're not covering the Little League team.
No, but in my heart I was.
You were. Okay. All right. So, Cheryl, let's talk a little bit about baseball because we know it's the second half of the season. I'm going to tell you right now, Cheryl, everybody knows I'm a huge Chicago White Sox fan. So I am excited about the second half of the season. But I got to tell you, back in May, the Chicago Cubs are doing so well. And I'm telling you right now, Chicago's a better place when both baseball teams are doing well. I thought this year was going to be the year, you know, we're getting that head-to-head. You know, we're coming on the back end of the Cubs winning the World Series and the Sox moving up. But then something happened to the Cubs. They kind of floundered, 11-game losing streak. And as a Sox fan, I don't bring any joy to say that. But so the teams are on two different trajectories. Why don't we start off with the Chicago Cubs because they just had a big trade and it seems like the end is near for that nucleus of the team. What do you tell us a little bit about the Cubs?
There's no doubt about that, Michael. When they went at 11-game losing streak, then Jed Hoyer, the president of the team, realized that this team is going to have to sell. They were not a playoff-type team. So yesterday, Hoyer traded Jock Peterson, who they signed as a free agent, to play left field and to be a left-handed bat. They traded him to Atlanta for a minor leaguer. This is just the beginning. We are hearing that there are a lot of trade talks. A lot of teams are interested in Chris Bryant and also Craig Kimbrell. I've also heard that a couple of the other big-time free agents, Javi Baez and Anthony Rizzo, they may try to retain. So right now, their biggest chip is Craig Kimbrell. He is a closer that's been on point almost the whole season. They could get a lot for him, and teams need closer at this point, especially as you get towards postseason. Now, with Chris Bryant, I've heard the Mets are one of the teams that are interested in him. Chris would bring some good prospects back. This team needs to rebuild. They have to figure out why their offense was broken, which Theo Epstein said to us right after 2019. They have not fixed it, so that's something they have to address. They also have to address their pitching situation. They don't have many pitchers that they've been able to elevate. They have a few. Keenan Thompson will be one. Justin Steele is another. And, of course, Adbert Elsley. So that's, you know, in a nutshell, what the Cubs are dealing with.
Yeah, and it seems that they were in that rut with the losing streak. And I know there was a couple of times when it could have just went three or four games. They had that big lead against the Milwaukee Brewers.
Seven runs. The first inning.
Yeah, and then they blew it. And that seemed like it was just a tailspin on there. When the Cubs are doing well, were you surprised when they were doing so well? Or is the season turning out the way a lot of people expected?
I think right now we're seeing what we expected. I think that winning streak was, you know, when they were winning in May, that was because they had some terrific players, that they had replacement players. I think you had players that were playing, above their skis. The other thing is we could not figure out much of this season because of last year only being 60 games. We could not figure out with all the injuries teams have had, you know, what we're going to see. So right now we're seeing probably the shakeout of what happened from last year, the spring training this year, and some of the injury issues that had to be overcome. And, Michael, what we're seeing, what we don't normally see at this point, we're seeing leads in the standings, and with the White Sox having a big lead, you know, that's something. But with Milwaukee, they're only four up on Cincinnati, but the Cubs are over eight games back. So we knew that for them during that win streak, once they came back down to earth, that this is where we thought they'd be.
But we are ending, or we're seeing near the end, of what was, I think, and you correct me if I'm wrong, probably the most successful stretch in the history of the Chicago Cubs.
Yes, this will probably be the end, no doubt about it. When we sat down with Judd Hoyer, the last homestand that they had before the break, he knows he's a seller. This is it. You know, they're going to try to, like I mentioned, to keep a couple of the players, but they know that they have a lot to do. And the fact is, their minor leagues have to produce. They do have some players down there that are really good, but they have to produce in the next few years. You're going to see a lot of young players going to come up. You're going to see them also, you know, acquire a player that's been waived. You're going to see them, you know, like they did in 2014, where you're making deals and then you're picking up players and you're trying to figure out what your core is going to be. They don't know exactly what their core is going to be unless they figure out what they're doing with some of these big-time free agents they have.
Right. And then, of course, the Chicago White Sox, they're up, I believe, 8 games starting the second half. So everything seems to be hunky-dory, but they've had a number of injuries. It seems like a new one is always popping up, but they're going to get some players back. What do you see in the second half of the season for the White Sox?
Well, you should start beating your chest there, Michael, because Eloy Jimenez should be up sooner than we expected. He's already at Triple A Charlotte, and he's performing there. We're seeing a team that has starting pitching. Number one, you have starting pitching like they do with Lance Lynn, All-Star, Carlos Rodan, All-Star. You know, Lucas Giolito. You have, you know, Dylan Cease and Dallas Keuchel. And the thing about them is Michael Kopech is also part of that mix. Don't forget that he is in the bullpen, but he could be used as a sixth starter if they want to rest some guys going down the stretch. So they're very strong in their pitching. In fact, they did make some transactions that you may not have heard about yet, but Aaron Bummer is coming back from the interlist, and Ronaldo Lopez is supposed to be brought up from AAA to be part of the bullpen. They sent down Jace Fry and Matt Foster. So their pitching situation is pretty stable. What has been really interesting is watching with some of the players that they had to replace because of injuries. Andrew Vaughn probably would not have made the team in spring training, but because of Eloy Jimenez's injury, he's had to play left field, and he's actually been very good at left field. You have Tim Anderson, all-star player. Again, he is an elite player. Jose Abreu can produce with RBIs. So you have all these players in place. Plus, when they brought up Gavin Sheets and Jake Berger, those guys, they contributed right away. So they know that they this is one of my beliefs. I believe when you have players in place, and if you don't have anybody in the minor leagues that can push them, they relax a little bit. I think everybody's on their toes because they know there are replacements.
Absolutely. And the one that really felt it was Yermín Mercedes, who was just on fire in April and then found himself back in the minors in June. So,
well, he never made the adjustments.
Yeah.
And that's what young players have to learn is when you go on a tear like that. Patrick Wisdom's finding that out too with the Cubs. Teams will make adjustments on you. You have to make the adjustments back. That's what Yermín missed out on.
Well, we got just a couple more minutes left, but let's talk a little bit about the Olympics. They're going to be starting up. We've seen problems already with the men's basketball team losing a couple of exhibition games. But the big news is COVID. Are they going to be able to pull this off? What do you think, Cheryl?
There's going to be some difficulties. They've already got Bradley Beal, the second leading scorer in the NBA. He cannot play because he's in COVID protocol. They actually had to cancel tonight's game with Argentina because of COVID. So there's a lot of problems with COVID with the Olympics. And what's really insane is that the IOC did not make it mandated for all the athletes to be vaccinated. Now, the training staff has to be, but not the athletes. I don't understand that. It doesn't make any sense. And the fact is that Japan has a very low vaccination rate, 15%, and they won't have fans in the stands. They won't even have the people presenting the medals to the winners. That's how bad it is right now.
So this is definitely going to be a very odd Olympics this year.
I think it's going to be very. I think they should have postponed it another year. I mean they should have thought about that. But they're worried about not making any of the money that they lost from last year. But this could be a real train wreck if things don't go right.
Are they even going to have an opening ceremony?
You know, I understand they're going to have one, but there's not going to be fans in the stands.
Yeah, so there's going to be nobody cheering and
right.
Doing
well,
all that.
It'll probably be like what I experienced last year when I was covering the White Sox and the Cubs going to Wrigley Field and Guaranteed Rate, where they had canned fans, and it was very spooky.
Yeah, that was spooky. So, all right, Cheryl, we're going to continue to follow your coverage. If you're interested in following Cheryl, she's on Twitter, Facebook. She's everywhere. She's WBEZ sports contributor. Cheryl, thank you so much for joining us again on Off Mic.
Anytime, Michael.
All right. And that's all we have for today's episode. I'd like to thank all my guests. You can hear this program again as a podcast by going to lakeshorepublicradio.org. And I want to thank my producer, Dee Dotson, for today. So stay healthy, stay safe, and have a great weekend. Thank you.